This little song that I'm singing about, people you know is true. If you black and gotta work for a living now, this is what they would say to you. This is, if you was white, you'd be alright. If you was brown, stick around. But as you black, oh brother, get back, get back, get back. I was in a place one night, they're all having fun. They're all buying beer and wine, but they would not sell me none. They said, if you was white, you'd be all right. If you was brown, you'd stick around. But as you black, oh brother, get back, get back, get back. To employ me at office, the number that I got in line. They called everybody's number, but they never did call mine. They said, if you was white, you'd be all right. If you was brown, you'd stick around. But as you black, oh brother, get back, get back, get back. Me and a man is working side by side. This is what it meant. They was paying him a dollar an hour, and they was paying me 50 cents. He said, if you was white, you'd be all right. If you was brown, stick around. But as you black, oh brother, get back, get back, get back. I hope built this country, and I fought for it too. Now guess that you can see what a black man have to do. He says, if you was white, it's all right. If you was brown, stick around. But as you black, oh brother, get back, get back, get back. I hope win sweet victory with my little plying hoe. Now I want you to tell me, brother, what you're gonna do about the old Jim Crow. Now if you's white, she's all right. If you's brown, stick around. But if you's black, oh brother, get back, get back, get back.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. You can listen to this program and many other wonderful programs at 96.5 FM in the Sacramento area. And if you're just joining us, we're listening to The Psychology Behind Morality and Politics. When it comes to moral judgments, Jonathan Haidt says, we think we are scientists discovering the truth, but actually we are lawyers arguing for positions we arrived at by other means.
And you also point out that, you know, when you talk about intuition, that our behavior is not primarily consciously driven, and that's the same thing that Buddha said, and it's the same thing that St. Paul said, and right, and Moses, and Ovid, and all of these people. So it's absolutely true that our traditions are repositories of moral thinking and moral grappling, and have brought those things across time. It's also true, and we certainly have this specter in the 21st century, that religious energies are at the center of a lot of the, well, morally justified violence, moral anguish. So how would you explain the fact that this seeming contradiction that religion, that religions are carriers of morality, and also that those very same energies become most destructive?
Well, if you think that morality is being nice and kind to people, well then, yeah, boy, it sure looks like a paradox. But if you go with me that morality is these many things, and a lot of it is, are you a good group member, or are you pursuing your own interests? And those group interests often are about intergroup conflict. Mm-hmm. So if you think about religion as functioning to bind groups together, well then, it's no paradox. A lot of that is nasty stuff.
I mean, here's something from your writing that It's a very striking statement. The myth of pure evil, and again, religions are a place we talk about good and evil. The myth of pure evil is the ultimate self-serving bias, the ultimate form of naive realism. That's a pretty strong statement.
Mm-hmm. One thing that you find in most of the great wisdom traditions is the idea that reality as we see it is an illusion, it's a veil, it blinds us, and enlightenment is taking down the veil, seeing things as they are, transcending dualities. And that, I think, is really crucial for thinking about civility, because that's what happened to me in writing this book and in doing this research, is I was a self-righteous, conservative-hating, religion-hating, secular liberal. And in doing this research over many years and in forcing myself to watch Fox News as an anthropologist would just, I got to understand this stuff. Over time, I realized, well, they're not crazy. You know, these ideas make sense. They see things I didn't see. The feeling of losing my anger was thrilling. It was really freeing when you get people to actually understand each other and they let down their guard and they learn something new and they see humanity in someone that they disliked or hated or demonized before. That's really thrilling. And that, I think, is one of the most important emotional tools we have to foster civility, because once you get it started, it's kind of addictive.
You can listen again and share this conversation with Jonathan Haidt through our website, onbeing.org. Coming up, where the rubber meets the road, we apply Jonathan Haidt's moral foundations theory to diverse reactions to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being, today with the social psychologist Jonathan Haidt. He is a leading thinker in the emerging field of positive psychology, especially the psychology behind morality. His research has helped illuminate how much of what we perceive as our defining moral values are unconsciously reflexive. He says we have inborn moral receptors just as we have physical taste buds. His science, he believes, is usable knowledge towards individual and social change. I interviewed Jonathan Haidt at the invitation of a group called Encounter, which attempts to calm an iconically entrenched, bitterly divisive moral conflict of our age, the Israeli-Palestinian relationship. I think that when you talk about something like the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, if you talk about, you know, the very emotional turmoil within the Jewish community, within the American Jewish community, just start there, where you're dealing with a conflict, a crisis that goes back generations, spirals of violence, and where there's this huge component of fear that is built into it. And among the other things we're learning about our brains, it is that when we are fearful, it's very hard to rise to, you know, let's just say, to make use of this kind of scientific knowledge that we're getting about ourselves as social beings. So it's kind of where the rubber meets the road, which is too mild.
All right, so let's start working on it.
Okay.
So, you know, I'm an ivory tower academic. I've only facilitated one meeting in my whole life of trying to get people together across the aisle.
I'm
will
glad
speculate
you told us
based
that.
On. But from what I've learned, from what I've seen, here are a few pointers. One is, if you accept what I was saying earlier about how our reasoning is driven by our intuitions, our gut feelings, our emotions, that's just why you cannot reason somebody to, once there's a conflict, you can't use reason to change their mind. So don't even try the direct route, which is let's just discuss it. Once you accept that, then you say, well, okay, well, what does change reasoning? And now relationships become absolutely crucial. Mm-hmm. This is why it's so hard to influence people just by putting a message up into message space. And this is what all the people are always interested in political messaging and crafting the message vehicle. And they always come to me for advice on this issue, that issue. I say, stop focusing on the message vehicle. Think a lot more about the messenger. Because if you have somebody who you wouldn't expect to say something, or if you have an alliance of people, so think a lot more about the total situation, and you're not going to change people's mind just with reason alone. So bring in interesting people who would be sometimes called unexpected validators, for one thing.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean unexpected? Unexpected validators.
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of people talk to me about, say, global warming, and they're always trying to craft the message. Well, how can we use the message to appeal to these conservative foundations and make those conservatives change their mind? You know, so I say things like, well, start by finding a military general who will talk about how this is going to be a threat to America's ability to project force around the world. But the even more important principle is build up the relationships between the people that you want to do the talking, because we engage in reasoning not to figure out the truth, but for social purposes, to show our team that we're good team players. So bring people together in a debate. People are actually not communicating with each other. They're actually communicating with their other
audiences. They're just defining themselves over against.
Right. That's right. But if you do the long, slow work of getting people to have something of a human relationship, and especially sharing food is a very visceral, primal thing. Once you've eaten, shared food with a person, there's a deep psychological system that means, you know, we are not like family.
Access Sacramento broadcasts great speeches and interviews every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m., or you can get the podcast at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Today we've had a national tragedy. Two airplanes have crashed into the World Trade Center in an apparent terrorist attack on our country.
We want to tell you what we know as we know it, but we just got a report in that there's been some sort of explosion.
For the 82nd floor, and I don't know where my peers are. I don't know. I hope to God they're okay. We saw a shadow. It looked like a plane. Next thing we know, it was boom, and the floor started shaking.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
That looks like a second plane.
I was happening to look on the first tower, and I actually saw people waving where the first plane crashed through, and then it was unbelievable seeing the second jet come crashing into the second tower. What is going on?
Heaven on earth, we need it now.
I was buried alive for 15 minutes until I scrambled out.
Sick of all of this, hanging around.
Oh my God, there it goes!
Sick of sorrow.
Oh my God. The second building has just come down.
Sick of the pain.
And the death toll, still uncountable.
Sick of hearing.
Is also unimaginable.
Again and again, that there's gonna be
a new part of the Pentagon that was one of the areas that was terribly hit.
Peace on earth.
There was billowing smoke. It was hard to see everything, but I clearly saw something worse than what Dante would have imagined. There was rubble, there was twisted metal.
And then we saw the people jumping. We saw what we thought was debris, and we realized it was people jumping.
And I clearly saw bodies and what appeared to be body parts strewn on the street, on the rubble itself.
I looked up as soon as we got across the street. I looked up, I saw the building start, the tower start to buckle. Three or four of us huddled together, and it was just black everywhere.
Where I grew up,
okay, there's been an explosion of some kind.
Where there was, we tear them down and use them on our enemies.
We don't see the smoke yet. Everybody's saying, get back. We're running. Hurry.
They say that what you...
The search is underway for those who are behind these evil acts.
We'll surely overtake you, and you become a monster. So the monster will not break you.
We talked to a couple of people who actually witnessed the plane going down and said it was quite devastating. Went right down into the woods. They saw all sorts of debris flying out into the woods and into the trees. And it's quite a devastating scene from what we're told.
U.S. officials are saying there was no warning, no indicators of any kind of a likely terrorist attack.
And it's already gone too far. You said that if you're going high, you won't get hurt.
The victims were in airplanes or in their offices.
Jesus, can you take the time to throw a drowning man a line? Peace on earth.
Moms and dads, friends and neighbors.
Tell the ones who hear no sound, whose sons are living in the ground. Peace on earth.
Thousands of lives were suddenly ended by evil.
No, who's a wise? No one cries like a mother cries for peace on earth.
Terrorist attacks can shake the foundations of our biggest buildings.
She never got to say goodbye, to see the color in his eyes. Now he's in the dirt.
But they cannot touch the foundation of America.
Peace on earth.
Today, America has experienced one of the greatest tragedies ever witnessed on our soil.
Out at Nellis Air Force Base, right now, they're at the highest alert possible.
They're reading names out over the radio.
America was targeted for attack because we're the brightest beacon for freedom.
All the folks, the rest of us, won't get to know.
And no one will keep that light from shining.
Sean and Julia.
There is a sense of war here at the Pentagon.
Gareth, Ann, and Breeder.
Completely shocked.
Their lives are bigger than any big idea. Jesus, can you take the time to throw a drowning man a line? Peace on earth.
This is the most tragic hour.
To tell the ones who hear no sound, whose sons are living in the ground, peace on earth.
In America's history. America's history.
Jesus, in the song you wrote, the words are sticking in my throat. Peace on earth.
Can't even look at it, because all I can see are people.
Hear it every Christmas time, with hope and history won't rhyme. So what's it worth? This peace on earth.
I thank the many world leaders who have called to offer their condolences.
Peace on earth.
Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death.
Peace on earth.
I fear no evil, for you are with me.
Peace on earth.
We said our thoughts and prayers are with those families and those injured and those who are the casualties of today's attack. We also remember those thousands of people who are rescue workers.
And now back to Psychology Behind Morality with Jonathan Haidt and Krista Tippett.
You use some really helpful metaphors and analogies. You talk about the moral matrix.
Mm-hmm.
Give us that.
That comes straight out of the movie The Matrix.
Right.
The Matrix is a consensual hallucination. And that's kind of cool. And, you know, the internet and all that stuff. But it was just the perfect metaphor for the moral world that we live in. It defines what's true and what's not true. It is a closed epistemic world. What I mean by that is it has within it everything it needs to prove itself, and it has within it defenses against any possible argument that could be thrown at it. It's impossible to see the defects in your own moral matrix.
So
again,
it becomes impossible to think beyond.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And that's why foreign travel is so good, getting disoriented is so good, reading literature can be so good. So there are ways of it getting out of your moral matrix, but it's hard, especially in the context of any sort of intergroup conflict. Then we're just locked into it, and our goal is defend the matrix, defeat theirs.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think a question that gets raised in this country, and I imagine that it might be on people's minds in this room right now, is that the people who most would benefit from those relationships, mm-hmm. or from stepping outside or seeing beyond their matrix, mm-hmm. are precisely the ones who are not going to go on the trips, mm-hmm. to the West Bank,
yeah.
right? Or whatever the other examples would be. Mm-hmm. Now, I think that we in this culture We tend to actually focus on the extreme poles and think that they are the ones who have to be convinced, and we always center the debates around them, and maybe that's what we do wrong. Mm-hmm. Do we need those extremists, or do we start without them and that's fine?
Yeah. So first, let me be clear that while each side can't see the flaws in its own matrix, there is a symmetry here, and left and right are similar in some ways. But one of the clearest differences between left and right psychologically is that the left is generally universalist, almost to a fault, and the right is parochial, often to a fault. And what I mean by parochial isn't just narrow-minded and dumb. What I mean is we have a survey at yourmorals.org where we ask, like, how much do you care about or think about or value people in your community, people in your country, people in the world at large? And, you know, okay, so conservatives value people in their nation and in their community much more than people in the world at large. And mm-hmm. you might say, well, okay, that's parochial. But what do liberals do? Liberals on our survey actually say they value people in the world at large more than people in their own country or than people in their community. So liberals are so universalist, they often don't really pay much attention to their own groups. Mm. As my mother said about my grandfather, who was a labor organizer, he loved humanity so much that he didn't really have much time to care for his family.
All right. Well, so let's open this up and see what's on your minds.
John, on this notion of your five factors that go into morality, and I believe it was fairness and compassion as being pretty much accepted across the spectrum as being moral values. and then you added others like sacredness or purity or authority. I think of authority and respecting authority as more amoral. If the authority is Abraham Lincoln, I see that as moral. If the authority is Hitler or Stalin, I don't. And so I'm sort of stuck with this notion of maybe a broader understanding of morality. If there is one position that is more right than another, how can we be open to respecting authority if our sense is that that authority is wrong?
Okay. So, I mean, a way to think about this is, I'm trying to be descriptive here. What is the morality that people around the world care about? And I was trying to step out of my own secular liberal morality. And if you think about the virtues as these excellences that we try to encourage in our children to prepare them for social interaction, and liberals and conservatives cultivate very different excellences. When I got to the University of Virginia, a lot of the students were from Southwest Virginia, and they would call me sir, and it was hard for them to call me by first name. And in seminar class, it was clear they had concepts of back talk, growing up Jewish American, there's no such thing as back talk. If your uncle says something stupid, you say, you don't say it's stupid, but you say, I totally disagree, that's ridiculous. But many people think that a world in which children can say shut up to their parents, or at least can take it or leave it or sue them or whatever they want, a lot of conservatives are horrified at the chaos, disorder, and disrespect in more liberal families. There often is a need for some sort of order, especially if a group is going to try to accomplish something. So keep in mind, conservative virtues are effective at keeping the group together and making it effective. Liberal values are more effective at getting justice within the group. So I think that's the key here.
But I think the question is that sometimes order is Abraham Lincoln and sometimes it's Hitler. Mm-hmm. And are you saying, maybe again in the grand scheme of things, that in the context of the human enterprise, the human experiment, that value which carries a lot of good is sometimes going to result in a Hitler?
Oh, I'm not saying people should be respectful of all authorities, nor am I saying that conservatives think people should respect all authorities. Conservatives certainly now don't respect Barack Obama just because he's the president.
Mm-hmm. Which mm-hmm. liberals perceive to be a real problem. Mm-hmm. Not respecting the authority of mm-hmm. the office.
Yeah.
So in that mm-hmm. sense, I think maybe that's a value that liberals don't realize they hold, but occasionally are reminded of.
Yeah. Let's see where to go with this. One thing that I noticed, what were really on display in sort of extreme cases, was Occupy Wall Street. So Occupy Wall Street was a very far left movement, and they were so far left that they were opposed to all forms of authority. Everybody was equal. And I went down there a few times and I watched them think about things. And what I saw so turned me off. I was very sympathetic to the movement at first, but they're so egalitarian that they couldn't have any leaders. Everybody had a right to speak equal to everyone else. At one point, there was a motion they were trying to figure out what they stood for. And they, for months they couldn't say what they stood for. And they were trying to draft a memo. And one line was, we reject violence. And somebody said, well, but there are some among us who don't reject violence, and we don't want to exclude them. We're so inclusive. We want to include everybody. And so that was one thing, was the extreme egalitarianism and inclusiveness rendered them, I thought, unfit for modern American political life. So complete rejection of authority leads to chaos. It leads to ineffectiveness, and it ultimately leads to the group disappearing.
You got plans. And now for something completely different.